Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and today is Monday, December 19th, 2011. This is BadQuaker.com podcast number 66. Before I get into today's topic, I want to bring up, there's a person in the Liberty Movement. She is an activist. I consider her an activist because she has actively been involved in stuff that, that really drew some attention to the Liberty Movement. Her name is Meg McLean, and she is trying to put together enough money to get out of Virginia and back up to New Hampshire in the Free State Project. So, what she's looking to do is earn money, and how is she doing that? She has a business. She has a graphics design business, and so I'm giving her some free airtime. I'm not giving her free airtime. I'm talking about her on the air, and I'm not charging her anything for it because she's a great person, and if we can throw some business her way and she can maybe earn some money and get up there and get among the Free State folks in New Hampshire, then there's no downside. So she has a graphic arts business on the internet. You can find it at megmclain.com. That's megmclain.com. And just click on, once you get there, click on the graphics design button that's across the top, and you'll see she has portfolio and she has rates. Drop into the rates button there, hit that button, and you will see that she has very reasonable rates for everything from business cards, web banners, whatever you need, flyers, posters, pamphlets, whatever you need, she'll probably work with you on it. And if you tell her that that I sent you over there, if you let her know that this is coming from Ben Stone at Bad Quaker, I'll bet you she'll give you a discount, because I know that she's trying to get to New Hampshire. And if you mention to her that I said that this is the purpose of this, to try to get her to New Hampshire, then I'll bet you she'll give you a good discount on her just phenomenal work that she does. Get over there, megmclain.com. And if you're not sure who Meg McLean is, just Google Meg McLean Jefferson Dance. Just Google that phrase, Meg McLean Jefferson Dance. She was at the Jefferson Memorial and was one of the activists there that protested the totally serious rule against doing anything like dancing at the Jefferson Memorial. So get over there to Meg McLean, and that's a totally free commercial I'm throwing out for before we really get into the podcast here. So that's the whole commercial. And now I'm going to jump into the main... Well, there is no main topic today. I'm just going to scatter around and talk about some junk. So, last week I took on some comments by Walter Block where he attacked another Liberty activist. And he made the proclamation that this person was not a true libertarian because they didn't support Ron Paul. And then he laid out his argument, and that was all over lewrockwell.com. And I put links to all that. That's all in last week's podcast. You can find that at badquaker.com. So anyway, I got some feedback, and some of the feedback was really good. Some of it was intelligent. Some of it was informative. Some of it was stupid. But even from stupid feedback, you can learn some things. If you look, I'm always look on the bright side of things, just like the Monty Python song. So anyway, one of the things that I wanted to mention about that is that, when you're making, when you're presenting rhetoric, that's what we're talking about here, where you're trying to convince someone by going through a series of steps to get them to see your point of view, or you're having an exchange with someone to get a third party to see that exchange between you and that person so that the third party can understand your point of view. For whatever purpose it is that a person argues a point or a person utilizes rhetoric to try to get a point across, there are ways to do this that are more effective, and there's ways that are less effective, and there are ways that are guaranteed not to work ever. And those ways that are guaranteed not to work ever come up on the internet with blinding, staggering frequencies. So I want to touch a couple of those. Now, let's just pretend in our mind we have a room, and within that room there's an anarchist, an anarcho-capitalist, and there's a minarchist. Let's say he's a libertarian minarchist. And he believes that government is necessary. He believes that the state is necessary. He cannot imagine the difference between the state and the government. And he cannot imagine a world where the state does not exist. Whereas the anarcho-capitalist supports a world where there is no state and recognizes that the government must be voluntary in order for it to be legitimate. And that means that if you don't want to support the government, you don't. Now, that's madness in the eyes or in the mind of the minarchist. So the two are discussing, and something that almost always comes up, one of the most common questions or statements that the minarchist can offer to the anarchist is, well, what would you do about roads and highways? How would you maintain things like transportation? Now, if the minarchist is honest and is coming into this conversation in an honest manner, and he's honestly saying, you know, what about this? Then the anarchist, hopefully, is informed enough to know that that's one of the most common things that we're asked, and we should always have the answer to that question right there. And, of course, the answer is blatantly easy to come up with. And I'm not here to defend roads today. I'm just pointing out the difference between rhetoric and proper argument and nonsensical argument. So, again, if the minarchist is honest, and if his attitude is one of, let's try to seek the truth and let's try to work this out together and find a common ground, then the anarchist has an opening to explain the anarcho-capitalist point of view on how roads and transportation and so forth could be done without a state. On the other hand, if the minarchist is a brainless idiot who just wants to make a snide remark and prove his point without really thinking about it, and if the minarchist has never really thought about any of this process whatsoever, he will often just throw out the statement, well, what would you do without what would you do without the state? You wouldn't have any roads. And this particular type of a statement is very common on the internet. It's not a statement that requires an answer. It's a statement that requires just going away and leaving that person, because that person doesn't want to know the answer. They've already thought in their mind that they are so cute and they're so smart that they've come up with the ultimate solution as to why anarchy doesn't make sense. And they didn't think it through, and they didn't Google it, and they didn't ask anyone in an honest manner. It just popped into their head, and they just spit it out, or maybe they heard it somewhere, so they just spit it out without thinking. They don't want an answer. They think they gotcha. That's what they think. They think they're so smart. They gotcha. Oh, it's roads. Oh, yeah, roads. Don't argue with them. Don't waste your time. If they ever will really come to a knowledge and understanding on the topic, they won't come to it by way of the quick, snappy little comeback. So, that's something that a minarchist can do to an anarchist. And the anarchist should spot that, and spot the real difference is in the attitude of the speaker. When the minarchist asks about roads, is he being honest, or is he really think he's gotcha on it? Well, here's another one. Wouldn't corporations destroy the environment without the state? Well, that's a legitimate question, as long as it's asked by someone in a legitimate way who actually wants to know what the anarchist position is on how to protect the environment. Now, this is also the same whenever a libertarian is speaking with a liberal, usually a liberal because, you know, honestly, conservatives generally don't care about that. But very often, this is a question that the liberals will honestly ask a libertarian. What would happen to the environment? How would we protect the environment without the state? Now, again, if the attitude of the person making the question is seeking knowledge and seeking a solution, then there's a world of answers there waiting for them. And it's very, it's almost joyous to find someone asking that question in an honest manner, because now you can go right into property rights and you can begin to explain to them that with the state, with the existence of the state, it guarantees that corporations will destroy the environment. But it's the state that gives those corporations its ability to do that and the motivation. And then you can go into property rights and you can explain how the state distorts property rights and how corporations would not have those advantages and would not get away with that stuff. If, again, if the person presenting the question is actually honest. But if they're just some environmental jerk, or just some nut job, or just some smart aleck, and they think they've got that one thing that's going to get the libertarian, or they've got that one thing they're going to throw down the anarchist once and for all. This is the one thing you can't answer. What about the environment? Don't waste your time. The person is not worth it. Wait until they grow up. And that means, I don't care if they're 70 years old. If they're presenting that to you with that kind of an attitude, do not waste your time. Okay, what's next? Well, without the state, the robbers would kick down your door. Okay, again, how is the question being presented? How would you defend your house if there was no police? How would you defend your house if the state didn't provide police for you? What would happen if robbers kicked down your door? Or, well, what would you do about robbers kicking? If you didn't have the state, the robbers would be killing you right now. Analyze the person's attitude. If they're just trying to have one of those gotcha moments, don't waste your time. Don't give them a moment. Just walk away from them, because they're not going to learn. And to engage them, what's the old phrase? If you try to wrestle a pig, you both come out covered in mud, and the pig enjoys it. Well, yeah. That should be on every forum. That should be a headline on every forum on the internet. If you wrestle a pig, you both get covered in mud, and the pig enjoys it. So if you really want to share the truth, if you really want to spread the concepts of liberty, spot these people when they throw stuff like this at you, and do not engage them. Now, the flip side of that, I see this so often that I just want to pull my hair out. You see someone who is either of the left leaning camp, and they're anti-war, like anti-war left leaning camp, or they're a liberty activist, which the true liberty position is anti-war, but not anti-defense. And this is a thing that can be explained in a calm, irrational fashion. But again, it's according to what the attitudes are that are being tossed around. Don't engage in a wrestling match with the pig. So, but the problem that I see with this is that people on the anti-war side will think that they have this gotcha, and they'll tell the usually right-wing or usually conservative person, well, what about your son? Or what about, would you send your son over there to that nasty place to get killed? Yes, they would. That's the whole point. That's why they're a right wing, or that's why they're a conservative, because they fall into that camp that believes the myth of the state, that they go and they will sacrifice their children on the altar of the state like that. So to throw that argument at them, you know, I heard this over and over. Back when in the 2008 campaign, when Sarah Palin and what was his name, John McCain, were on the Republican side, and Obama was on, you know, and he and his, I can't remember the vice president's name. Anyway, and anti-war was actually a discussion, because there were those of us in the liberty movement that are saying, look, both these clowns are for war. Obama's going to continue the wars. Obama's going to keep bombing people. Obama's going to keep killing people. He's not your peace candidate, and the left didn't believe us. Hello, left. Where are you? However, anyway. But the people on the left were pointing at this murder coalition, this pro-war, kill everybody who's not like us coalition of Sarah Palin and John McCain, And there were these statements coming out. Well, Sarah Palin wouldn't be so pro-war if it was her own children. It is. It is. They're happy to sacrifice their children. Look at John McCain himself. Look at John McCain. He practically got barbecued in the cockpit of an airplane sitting on a flight deck because of some either malfunctions or incompetence or whatever caused the problem. He was in the Navy sitting in a plane, and a bomb went off on the deck where he was at and almost killed him, almost cooked him to death. He barely got out of it with his life. Then they shipped him off. Well, they didn't ship him there. He got shot down, and he ended up in a prisoner of war camp being tortured. Yes, they will sacrifice their children to the state. Look back through history. These people always have. That's not the way to get to their hearts and their minds, by telling them that they are you going to sacrifice your child to the state? Of course they're going to sacrifice their child to the state. And all that you're going to do by bringing it up, especially in an insultive manner, is drive a wedge where you can't reach them on any other topic. So don't approach the right-wing person in that fashion. Don't approach them, well, would you kill babies in war? Well, that's you're not doing any good. What you're doing is the same thing as the guy says when he goes, well, what would you do about the roads? You're being that same guy when you do that to a person on the right. Instead, get to know what they actually believe. The best way to do that is ask them questions. It's not to charge them and throw riddles at them that you think are cute or that you think are the one answer that's going to shoot down that right-wing guy. That's not how to bring that person into a position of understanding what the liberty movement is. And really, if you're listening to this and you're realizing how much fun it is just to engage in battle with those people, verbal battle or internet battle, by going back and forth, well, you know, honestly, I don't have anything for you, because there's nothing positive in that. Again, let's go back to pigs wrestling in the mud. There's nothing positive. You don't help the liberty movement when you're wrestling in the mud with a troll. It does nothing to help us. Okay, so don't do that to people on the right. An argument when you're talking to someone on the left, a way to look like that same jerk is to say something like, well, if you believe that people need to help the poor so much that you rob tax money and give to the poor, why don't you give money to them yourself? This argument, the person on the left has already established in their minds that we all owe the poor something. We all owe the poor something because the poor are poor because the rich people have stolen from them. They already believe that in. Their mind is already polluted to that extent. So for you to just jab at them like that, it's the same thing. You don't understand what they believe. Therefore, how can you present an argument that's going to make sense to them? First, ask them questions. Find out what they actually do believe. And you'll find out that their position with the poor is probably very noble, but misguided. They probably believe that if they just tax rich people more and give it to the poor, they'll fix the problem. They probably believe that. And for you just to poke them in the eye is not going to, you know, you're doing the intellectual equivalent of a poke in the eye. You're not going to convince them of anything with these I gotcha moments like that. Okay, so now, what brought that up? Well, speaking of wrestling with pigs. So I said that I had gotten, you know, all kinds of different feedback from my podcast that I did about Walter Block and him being the boss of who's going to choose who is a libertarian and who isn't a libertarian based on the almighty Walter Block's opinion. And I got some, like I said, I got some positive feedback, and some people made some really good points. One of them that was not a good point was some idiot did exactly like what I'm saying here. Do you file tax returns? Well, you know, that's just like the argument that someone throws at an anarchist. Well, do you drive on the roads? Do you eat food that comes from a corporation? Did you eat food from the grocery store? These same stupid, idiotic jabs like that. Don't answer them. Don't bother with them. They don't want the answer. They don't want to know the truth. If they wanted to know the truth, they wouldn't jab like that. They would ask in a intelligent, reasonable fashion. I'm thinking of one of the other people that ask me in an intelligent fashion, well, if we're not going to be supporting Ron Paul, who can we support? I mean, who is of that mind that we can get behind? And you could tell by the way he proposed the question that he was sincere. And that's totally different from somebody just saying, well, what would you do about roads? Or do you pay taxes? Or did you file income tax? Did you get a refund? Don't deal with idiots like that. Just realize you're looking at a little piggy and decide in your mind, I'm not going to roll in the mud with you. I don't care how happy it makes you. Okay, so let me look at my notes here. Try to orient myself to what I was talking about. Here's something. Now, somebody caught me on this. I had said that we don't need leaders. We're libertarians and we're anarcho-capitalists. What do we need with a leader? Well, that's probably a bad terminology. I should have been more specific because, as the person pointed out to me, we're okay with leaders. It's the initiation of force that's the problem. When the leader takes it on himself to start initiating force. And that was a good correction, exactly right. And what I should have done was clarified more specifically what I was talking about because... when the leader initiates force, of course, it's illegitimate and he becomes a tyrant. But a person who is respected, a person who is looked up to like a Walter Block or a Ron Paul or whoever, when they begin to use their position in a recognized situation, like Walter Block or a Ron Paul or whoever, and they begin to use intimidation, whether that's verbal intimidation or whether it's social intimidation, or whether it's we're all going to gang up on you if you don't do X, Y, Z, even if it's not a physical initiation of violence, you can still have bullying present without the actual threat of violence. You can still bully people without physically assaulting them, and that's exactly what Walter Block has been doing, whether we're talking about when he was talking to about Stefan Molyneux on this topic, or when he was, I hate to say it, but I can't remember who he was attacking. Oh, that's right, Wendy McElroy. He was attacking Wendy McElroy. And so whether we're talking about, when Walter Block attacked Wendy McElroy, or whether we're talking about when Walter Block attacked Stefan Molyneux, either way, he was being that kind of a leader that uses bullying techniques, and even though it's not physical aggression, it's still aggression. And it's maybe, if there are degrees of aggression, if somebody, barks some orders at you, or if somebody actually comes up and shoves you, or if somebody comes up and pokes a knife in your arm, or if somebody comes up and sticks a gun to your face, there are degrees of bullying and there are degrees of aggression. And what Walter Block was committing there when he was bullying Wendy McElroy and Stefan Molyneux, he was committing aggression as a leader. And that's the kind of leader we don't need. We need actually... if you consider Ron Paul, Ron Paul never does that. Ron Paul would never do that. So in that sense, Ron Paul, even though I'm still holding my position, I'm not voting for anybody because I'm not gonna support the system, and I'm not gonna sit back and say, yes, I want Ron Paul to be my president, because that in itself, Ron Paul being president is Ron Paul being in a position of aggression. And I don't want anything to do with that. I don't want a president. But at least Ron Paul, as he presents himself in leadership, he doesn't talk down to people like that. He doesn't use intimidation to try to force us to join his cause and get behind him and send him money. But that's exactly what Walter Block was doing. So I failed when I was explaining that. I should have made a distinction between the type of aggression that Walter Block was using, the intimidation and the bullying, and legitimate leadership where I tried but failed. I tried to compare it to products in the marketplace and how different products serve a different purpose. So the Walter Blocks and the Ron Pauls and the Wendy McElroys and all these people serve a different purpose in the marketplace of libertarian ideas and libertarian processes. So I tried to make the comparison there where, you know, in a marketplace, you might choose one apple. You might choose an apple over an orange, or you might choose one apple over the other apple. And that's what we do in the marketplace of libertarian ideas. So in that sense, you know, one product over the other is fine. To call one a leader is fine. But it's when the bullying and the levels of aggression begin that the problem starts to manifest itself. So yeah, I should have presented that in a clearer tone, and I appreciate the help that I was given there. Now, the other thing that I got a little criticism for was that perhaps my estimate of 30% is too high for how many libertarians are out there. Well, let me just clarify, because I may not have made that clear enough either. I'm not talking about voters. I'm talking about, and I'm not even talking about people who have really thought through things. So they're not libertarians in the sense that they have intelligently thought out their position and realized that they are indeed a libertarian. But the natural law aspects of the libertarian philosophy are so in our minds, so deeply set, just like I've talked before about geese knowing which direction to fly and butterflies making their way from central Mexico to the plains of Canada. Just like that, natural law is within the human mind. And I believe probably about a third of humans, given the right circumstances, would naturally choose that all the time. The problem is with that 30% number, and it may be higher, it may be closer to 60%, really. But the problem with any number is that the state has so indoctrinated so many of us from such a young age that it's almost impossible for the average person to think in those realms. The brainwashing is so efficient, and the state is so invasive into so many aspects of society and in so many countries. This is not just in the U.S. In so many countries, the state has invaded all of the aspects of society to the point of where it's very difficult for people to interact with each other and learn how to behave in a truly in a natural fashion. So that has washed it out of the mind. But if we could somehow slowly remove the brainwashing, then more and more people would choose to act in, well, Stefan Molyneux, speaking of him, talks about the universally preferred behavior. And we're talking about very high percentages of people that this is natural to them to think in these ways, but they have been so, these tendencies have been so held down that they don't pop up in many of the aspects of life where they would otherwise, if all the avenues of the state were not around us in every possible direction, trying to force us to think like a statist. So I'll defend my 30%, but, and I'll say it may even be dramatically higher than that. But of course, as I'm saying, those people are not voters, and those people, the vast majority of them, haven't really thought through their position. Now, these are some of the best people to get to with the libertarian message, because if you can come to them using not the message of liberty, but the moral message, move into their mind in ways that they already believe, if they already have a natural understanding of morals, then you begin to show them that the liberty position is the only moral position. And then they begin to see the immorality of the state, and then you begin to present them with options that are moral. And the more that they begin to see that, the more that they'll understand how evil the state is and how moral the libertarian view is. So those people, in my mind, are entirely reachable. Now, since I'm throwing out numbers, let me throw out something I've said for years. Since I said perhaps 30% of people are libertarian, let me throw this out too. On any particular day, and I'm included in these numbers, in any particular day, I think about a third of all people are being stupid. And like I said, this includes me. I think about a third of the time a regular person does things without thinking about it. And that's those moments are when we act without thinking, we're being stupid. Me too. And I think that at any particular moment, about a third of the public fits that category. They're being stupid right now. Now, I also believe that at any particular time, about a third of the general public are pretty dumb. I mean, it's just they're just not reachable. And not only that, they're just not that bright. They may be libertarian, they may be right-wing conservative, they may be left-wing, they may be liberal, they may not be any of those things, they may be totally neutral on politics, they may be some important person in business, they may be, you know, it may be their job to pick up cigarette butts at a convenience store. It doesn't matter. It's not my point. My point is, I believe about one-third of human beings are idiots all the time, full-time idiots. And I believe another third of us are, like me, are part-time idiots. We sometimes just do things without thinking about it. Now, that means that at any particular time, only about a third of the people of the public are actually thinking about what they're doing. Now, if you think about that when you're driving down the road, you're in traffic or you're in a freeway, you're on a freeway, you're driving along and you look around and you see what drivers are doing. Well, they might be talking, they might be on the phone, they might be texting, they might be listening to their music, they might be doing pretty much anything. But if you look around, you'll notice probably only about a third of them are really paying attention to what they're doing. Now, I came to this conclusion because for years and years and years, I rode a motorcycle, you know, summer, winter, rain, shine, it didn't matter the conditions, snow, ice, sleet. If the roads were open, I rode my motorcycle to work about 30 miles each direction. And when you're on a motorcycle on the freeway, especially in bad weather, you realize something all the time, or you die. And what this is that you realize is that the moment you stop thinking about what you're doing, you could die. And so all the time that I was on that motorcycle, all the time I was in traffic, I strove to teach my mind to stay alert and to look at every car and look at every driver and analyze whether that driver was paying attention or whether he's getting ready to come into my lane without even knowing I'm there. Because if you don't ride a motorcycle with that mentality, they'll get you at some point. So for that reason, you know, I've ridden now, I say this quite often, I've ridden over 750,000 miles without ever wrecking on the street, without ever wrecking a street bike in almost 750,000 miles. I can't ride nowadays because of my disability, but all the years that I rode, I made it a point to focus on the drivers around me. And that's how I came to that conclusion. About a third of the people I saw were totally spaced out. I mean, they're just not paying attention. They're eating a bagel with one hand. They're steering with their elbow. They're fiddling with the radio with the other hand. I used to see a guy regularly on the freeway when I was driving back and forth to work. I would see this one guy, I would say at least once a month, I would pass him on the freeway. And I'm not kidding, he had a newspaper on his steering wheel, and he usually had some item of food in one hand. And often he'd have a cup of coffee in the other hand. And he would be driving, eating, drinking hot coffee, reading his newspaper on the freeway going into city traffic on the freeway. And I would see this guy regularly. And I would look at him and I'd think, well, he's either like the world's smartest man that he can multitask to this level. I doubt that. Or else he's extremely dangerous and he's an idiot. So that's how I came to that conclusion, that there's about a third of the people that are full-time always idiots. And there's about a third of the people who are part-time idiots. We're idiots at this particular moment, but usually we're okay. And then there's about a third of the people that are actually paying attention. And those last two groups, the ones that are paying attention and the ones that are part-time idiots, we fold back and forth between those all the time. So where was I going with that? I was just rambling. That's where I was going. I suppose the point being that if that's the case, then two-thirds of people are not really, you can't reason with two-thirds of the people at any particular time, because they're either full-time idiots or they're not paying attention right now. Baggy the cat's attempting to get my attention, and so I have to put her off again. Okay. That's one of the, if you're a new listener to badquaker.com, we have a regular interruption here. Baggy the cat sees me talking into a microphone, and she decides that she has to come up and try to disrupt the process because, you know, how could I possibly be talking to that microphone and not rubbing her face? So she's very jealous of the microphone. Anyway, so let's try to move on from that. I'm going to touch on something. You know, I got quite a bit of feedback about the Walter Block thing and the Ron Paul thing. And like I said, it was good and it was bad and some of it was dumb and all of it, I look at all of it as educational. So I was thrilled to see the feedback. I was really happy. So now I'm going to throw something out that, considering how fanatical some people are on this topic, I could be getting feedback that I really don't want, but I'm going to throw it out anyway. Are you familiar with peak oil? Let me explain peak oil to you really quick. Now, if you are already familiar with peak oil and you think you've heard it a million times, hang with me because this is not going to be a big, long peak oil lecture. This is just going to be a quick thought on the topic. Peak oil, a lot of people are confused. They think peak oil is when we run out of oil. Well, no, that's not what peak oil is. Peak oil is when the demand for oil and the capability to get oil on the market, when those two things cross in such a way that it causes the price of oil to spike. Now, this can happen with any particular commodity. Let's say we weren't regrowing corn every year. There was only a limited amount of corn that we had to find in order to get the corn. Well, then we could have a peak corn. We could also have peak corn if our ability to grow more corn were limited to a specific quantity and the demand for that corn reached the point of where it began to intersect with that. When the demand and the supply begin to intersect, then it reacts with a price fluctuation. So peak oil is when the worldwide demand for oil gets to the point of where the worldwide supply of the oil starts to drive the price up very quickly and very dramatically. Now, some people are very concerned about this because, in all honesty, it could happen very quickly. There have been fears at times that it would happen, that we were on the verge of peak oil. This was first brought about around the early 1900s. And then it came out again in the 1920s and the 1930s and the 1950s and the 1970s. There was regularly this fear that we were going to hit peak oil. And there was real genuine reason to believe this at different times because we just didn't know how much that there was available. And they tell us they have a real good idea of how much oil is available. But honestly, they really are not sure. So we don't really know at what point we reach peak oil, and we don't really know if that's now or soon or not long from now or if it's going to be a long time from now. We don't know. For sure, there are good theoretical models, but we don't know. But here's the problem with peak oil. If you're a Keynesian economist or if you're a Chicago School of Economics economist, if you're a liberal or if you're a conservative, if those are your mindsets already, then it's entirely logical for you to worry about peak oil. using those mindsets, the Keynesian economics, the Chicago economics, the right wing, the left wing mentality. If you think in any of those realms, then the more you understand about peak oil, the worse it's going to scare you, because it could get really, really bad. But if you understand Austrian economics and you understand the economics of how things actually work in real life, and you get away from the mysteries and the religion of Keynesianism and Chicago economics, all the socialist, because now here I'm going to upset anybody who's a fan of the Chicago School of Economics, but Chicago School of Economics supports socialism, and so does Keynesianism. Keynesian economics is in support of socialism. So, if you're a socialist, you should be scared to death of peak oil, if you're a consistent socialist. But if you're a libertarian, if you're an anarcho-capitalist, if you're an Austrian economist, you should have absolutely no fears of peak oil. And you say, Ben, you're nuts, we're going to run out. No. Listen, there was a time when there was peak oil, and it was real. The supply was absolutely running out, and the demand was going through the roof, and something had to be done, and the price went nuts. It was whale oil, and this was the early 1800s. And what do you know? The market adjusted, and new products came on the line and fixed the problem. Now, one argument can be that the state has messed up the market so bad that innovation and invention are crippled, and therefore peak oil can take place because innovation and invention in the market are completely at a point of non-functional because of the interference of the state. Now, that could be a legitimate argument. If that's the case, then peak oil will crush the state. It's that big. It will crush the state. If the market is so crippled that it can't fix the problem of peak oil, then the state's going to be crushed by it. But that's peak anything. That can be peak corn. That can be peak bananas. It can be peak chocolate Hershey bars. The state is based on socialism. Socialism creates gluts and shortages because it has no price mechanism. And so there is no signal to go to the market to tell the market what to produce and in what kind of quantities and what kind of prices to charge. And this lack of information into the market causes socialism to have to upset the market and causes gluts and shortages. So the state will cause a shortage in oil at some point in time. And at some point in time, peak oil will happen. And at some point in time, if the state has retarded the market's capabilities so bad that the market can't deal with it, it will crush the state, and it will be ugly. It will be serious ugly. But whatever crushes the state, and it doesn't matter if it's peak oil, or if it's peak corn, or if it's peak something else that I can't even imagine, or something that's going to be invented 300 years from now that is so far out from our brains that we don't even know what's going on. It doesn't matter what it is. At some point, some commodity will reach a peak and the state won't be able to fulfill it, and the chaos that results from that will crush the state. Ta-da! And that's what we're waiting for. So the anarchist, the libertarian, the market anarchist, that is, the anarcho-capitalist, the Austrian economist should not fear peak oil. Well, I shouldn't say shouldn't fear it. It will be nasty. If like I'm saying, if the state has completely stopped the market's ability to fix problems, then it could get nasty. It could get real nasty. But then again, that's why I constantly say that the anarcho-capitalist should prepare for the fall of the state. The anarcho-capitalist, the libertarian, should be doing things to get yourself independent of the state, because it will fall. All the things that we believe that our flaws of the state will crush the state at some point. And we have to be prepared for two things. We have to be prepared to survive through that fall of the state, which will be really, really ugly. And we also need to prepare intellectually so that we can present the answer when the state falls. And that's the two things that libertarians have to do. We educate ourselves and our families and the people that are close to us and whoever can hear our voice. We educate them to the morality of liberty and the immorality of the state so that when the state falls, we can present the option to whoever's left. And we prepare for the fall of the state. And by that, I don't mean, you know, I always pick on the Western states. I say something like, you're hiding in a cave in Idaho, or you're hiding in a cave in Montana, or you're hiding in a cave. Well, I wish I had a cave in Montana. That'd be cool. But and I might even hide in it, at least for a while. But that's not what I'm talking about when I say surviving the collapse of the state. I can't imagine how it could be done, but I believe that surviving the collapse of the state could be done inside of a city, could be done in a small town, could be done in a village, could be done anywhere in the world if you are adapted to that setting and you understand the threats of that setting and you understand how the state will fail and what other people's reactions to it is going to be. And if you take the proper steps to prepare yourself for that to take place, I believe, I'm not certain of this, but I believe that you could pretty much survive anywhere. For me personally, I'm not adapted to the big cities, so I'm not going to be anywhere near a city when the state collapses. And let me clarify one more time, when I'm talking about the state collapsing, I'm not talking about the United States government. As a matter of fact, I'm not talking about government at all. There will be government failures. There will be government failures on all levels because the government today is polluted by the state. But government, like leadership, what I was talking about earlier, government can be voluntary. Government can be based on voluntary relationships, voluntary choices, voluntary support of the government, and voluntary actions. Government can be that way. It's when government resorts to violence and aggression and threats, intimidation and lies. It's when government does those things that it becomes an aspect of the state. But the state is not just the government. The state requires a government to function. But the state is bigger than that. The state includes, the immoral, illegal banking industry. It involves the corrupt union officials. It involves the giant corporations that manipulate government to get what they want and that use government to drive monopolies and control the market. That's all the state. The state is not this government. The state is not corporations. The state is not the banks. The state is not the unions. The state owns all those things. The state manipulates and controls all those things. The state is that thing in your mind where you believe that if you just get this one guy elected, he'll fix everything for you. That thought right there, that faith in this thing, this faith in this, in not in the person, not it's not if you believe Ron Paul can do something to help the country, that's Ron Paul is not the state. But your belief that somebody can go into the state and fix the state, that belief is the state. When you believe that, when you accept that in your mind, you've accepted the state. Whenever you think in your mind that this can't be done without the state exists. You believe it's real, therefore it is real. And people act on that belief. So the actions of people become the actions of the state, but there is no state. It's a figment of your imagination. And if you stop believing in it and you purge it out of your mind, then your eyes begin to open and you begin to see that Ron Paul's just a man. And the government is not necessary for most things. And what it is necessary for, it can be done on a voluntary basis. You start to understand these things. And your mind goes beyond the state. And you can begin to understand that things like peak oil can be devastating to society and devastating to the economy, but they'll kill the state at some point in time. Some peak something will be the tipping point that will kill the state. And when it does, if you've already understood in your mind that there is no state, when it vanishes out of everyone else's mind, you'll already be that step ahead and you can present the answer to them. Okay, so where do we go from here? Oh my, oh do I dare. I should take the safe path right here and go back and get an old file that I've done from earlier in the year and just tape it into the podcast right here. That would be the safe thing to do, because if I read what I have in my notes, I'm liable to talk way too long. I read it. Okay, so I'm active on forums, and I read a lot more forums than I actually post on. But I look around on the internet, and I poke around, and I see this, and I see that, and I watch conversations, and sometimes I engage in conversations. And I have to say this, you know, there's this myth. It's a myth in some cases. It's an open lie in other cases. Those representing the state, you know, the George W. Bushes and the Cheneys and now the Obamas. But this is most closely associated with the more right-wing types and the militant aspect. But either way, there's this thing that they throw out and lie about, that the Muslim world, or at least the people in the Middle East, hate the West or hate Americans or hate, you know, whoever, because of their freedom. And so this level of fear is thrown into the mix, because this justifies all the things that the state wants to do throughout the Middle East, invading and bombing and killing and dominating and stealing and all the things that the state does. If it can convince people in the West that all those people in the Mideast, all those scary people, hate you because you're free, and they hate Hollywood because of miniskirts, and they hate America because we eat pork, and they hate, you know, they all these lies that are fed to the American public and to the West as in general. These things are fed to us, and the whole purpose is to get us to not only fear but hate them. And as this takes place, the state at the same time, from Muslims and from people in the Middle East, the state is telling them, watch out for those people in the West. Watch out for those crazy Christians. Watch out for the evil Jews. They're out there in the West and they want to steal everything. The reason you're poor is because they're doing this to us. And they just want to attack and kill all of our free countries in the Middle East. The same lie is being fed to both sides, and both sides on massive levels are accepting it as truth. And as long as the people allow themselves to get fooled by this lie, they just let the state continue to ravage both sides. Now, the thing is, though, that as you begin to look at this argument, and you begin to see who, not the evil guy, not the obvious evil people like Obama and Bush and people like that, not the obvious liars like those people, but back on the internet forums and back on day-to-day discussions with your coworkers and people you know and your neighbors and so forth, people buy the fear and they develop hate based on that fear. Fear and ignorance of the facts drive these people towards hate. And the same thing is happening in the Middle East, and the same thing is happening in the Muslim community, and the same thing is happening in the Jewish community. this fear that's being pushed onto us and ignorance of the situation as a whole drives more and more hate. So we get to the point at some point, we get to where they actually do hate us and we actually do hate them. And there becomes more and more of a justification for killing each other. But if you really look at it, why does the Middle East, why do people in the Muslim countries hate the West? Is it really because people in Hollywood wear miniskirts? Is that really what upsets them so bad? Or is it the fact that we manipulate their governments, prop up puppet governments, keep dictators in power, remove and replace governments at our will, dominate their economies, force them to use petrodollars instead of whatever they want to use for means of exchange? Does that have nothing to do with it? When we bomb their cities, when we randomly blow up a group of teenagers because one of them is the son of somebody who is a bad guy, and so we preemptively kill him because he might grow up to be bad, that's not an abstract question. The U.S., Obama, did that. They killed a teenager and the other kids that were with him simply because his father was a militant, and they were afraid that he and Obama had just killed his father, and they were afraid that he would become radicalized and be like his father. Not that he was radicalized, not that they had ever seen any indication that he would radicalize, but that he might radicalize, so they killed him and the other teenagers that were with him. Now the state does that, and they justify it based on this illogical fear that creates hate and then justifies their actions. So if we individuals cut off the ability of the state to produce fear in us, then we cut off the ability of the state to produce hate, and we educate ourselves. And if there's no ignorance and there's no fear, there's no hate. And the more we can spread that, the more peaceful we all are. And then we're going to reach a new peak, a peak of running out of something like peak oil, except it will be, for the state, it will be peak support of war. It will be the peak of people buying the lies that create the wars. I don't have time to go into it today, but if we sat down and went through every war that the United States has been in since its inception, I could give an argument that there have been no justified wars in the U.S. And I'm not going to go into that. That's a teaser for another episode of BadQuaker.com podcast. Now, one last thing. Be sure and get over there to Meg McLean's website. If you have anything that you need, a logo for, business card, banners, any kind of graphic design, Meg McLean, MegMclain, help her out and help her get some honest money so that she can work her way and move and join the folks at the Free State Project in New Hampshire. And if you're in New Hampshire and you want to help a fellow liberty activist to move up there, get over to Meg's website, buy yourself a business card logo and let her help you design that logo and get yourself a business card and get yourself a business going and get yourself independent from the state. Thanks a lot, folks. Be sure and get to badquaker.com. I appreciate you listening. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, get to badquaker.com. Thanks, folks.